The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. This month's book is Small Island by Andrea Levy, which not only won the Orange Prize in 2004, but went on to be acclaimed the best of the best. That's the best Orange Prize winner in the first 10 years of the prize's history. It also won the Whitbread Book of the Year and the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, and now features among many school students' must-read lists as part of the A-level curriculum. It's a novel that inspires fierce devotion, as our book club audience told John Mullen. "She gave us a voice," said one woman. We open with a sample of that voice from Andrea Levy herself.
I always think it's nice to hear a bit of a novel that you're going to talk about. And I just wanted to read you just a couple of bits, because we've got four narrators in Small Island. I just wanted you to get an idea of the sound of their voices as I was writing them in my head. I'm starting with the first two, which are Queenie and Hortense. And if there's time later, then we'll do Bernard and Gilbert. "There was a lot of discussion about what we should see. The whole world and only one day to see it. Mother was not interested in the different woods of Burma or the big game trophies of Malaya. She said, maybe later, to the coffee of Jamaica. Oh no, to the sugar of Barbados. What for? To the chocolate of Grenada. And where in heaven's name is that? To Sarawak. In Canada, there was a life-size model of the Prince of Wales made in yellow butter. I had to struggle to the front to get a good look. I pressed my face close to the glass and Mother came and dragged me back. You hold Emily's hand, she told me. I don't want you getting lost. Then she moaned at Emily in front of the crowd, who strained to look past my mother and her blushing outside girl, everyone muttering, butter, really? Butter? Never. Mother told Emily that she'd only been brought along to look after me and that if she lost me, then she would be in trouble. Very big trouble indeed. So Emily attached herself to me like soot to a miner. And where Emily went, Graham followed. Australia smelt of apples, ripe, green, crisp apples. A smell so sharp and sweet it made my teeth tingle. We'll have some of them, Father said, as he joined a queue to buy a small brown bag of the fruit. Mother saved hers until later, but I ate mine and gave the core to Emily. Graham then told us all that he was going to live in Australia. Australia? You daft beggar, Father laughed. I was promised that I would see a sheep being sheared in New Zealand, but we only arrived in time to see the skinny shorn animal trotting round the pen with a fleece at the side. Hong Kong smelt of drains, and India was full of women brightly dressed in strange, long, colourful fabrics. And all these women had red dots in the middle of their forehead. No one could tell me what the dots were for. Go and ask one of them, Emily said to me. But Mother said I shouldn't, in case the dots meant they were ill, in case they were contagious. And now I'm just going to read a little bit of Hortense. It brought it all back to me. Celia Langley standing in front of me, her hands on her hips and her head in a cloud. And she is saying, oh, Hortense, when I am older. All her dreaming began with, when I am older. When I am older, Hortense, I will be leaving Jamaica and I will be going to live in England. This is when her voice became high class and her nose pointing to the air. Well, as far as her round, flat nose could. And she swayed as she brought the picture to her mind's eye. Hortense, in England, I will have a big house with a bell at the front door, and I will ring the bell. And she made the sound, ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling. I will ring the bell in this house when I am in England. That is what will happen to me when I am older. I said nothing at the time. I just nodded and said, you surely will, Celia Langley, you surely will. I did not dare to dream that it would one day be I who would go to England. It would one day be I who would sail on a ship as big as a world and feel the sun's heat on my face gradually change from roasting to caressing. But there was I, standing at the door of a house in London and ringing the bell, pushing my finger to hear the ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling. Oh, Celia Langley, Where were you then with your big ideas and your nose in the air? Could you see me? Could you see me there in London? Hortense Roberts married with a gold ring and a wedding dress in a trunk. Mrs. Joseph, Mrs. Gilbert Joseph. What do you think of that, Celia Langley? There was I in England, ringing the doorbell on one of the tallest houses I had ever seen.
I was thinking, as you were reading that, Andrea, what I said at the beginning about the novel's popularity, I suppose, that I wondered, I mean, it's got a very, as we heard, it's different voices. It's also got a back and forth chronology. Mm-hmm. It's cheering that a book that's actually so complicated structurally has been so loved and so popular. I mean, did you feel when you were putting it together, when you were constructing it, because it is like a kind of complicated architectural thing, that you were taking a bit of a risk in making it, you know, multiple narrators and sort of existing in lots of different, in different times?
I didn't think I was taking a risk, no. And the thing is, the way that I wrote it in different bits and then sort of put it together at the end. So I wasn't writing it in a chronology. So I hadn't sort of realised the back and forth and quite so much as you would have thought I would have done. It was only once I'd got it all, the whole there, I realised that we were, you know, it was going back and forth and it was doing... But I didn't think that it would be a problem for people. And I don't think it's proved a problem.
No,
although,
hasn't.
Yes, when it first came out, I think that there were some people, maybe in America, who sort of said, oh, I don't like the back, you know. you know, it's a bit tough for them, but... nobody has ever sort of said that since then.
In a way, some of these kind of structural tricks, which maybe, I don't know, 30 or 40 years ago would have made a book seem rather avant-garde, and now things which readers are sort of quite ready to accept.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I learned my storytelling from TV and film.
Yeah.
And I think we're very used to the vocabulary of sort of going back and forth and doing all sorts of staying with a plot and
yes.
knowing that it's
yeah.
gone back and gone all wibbly and you know it's sort of, you know. So I don't think think it's so difficult to do it in storytelling, in a written book anymore.
And the multiple narrators, you had to have these people only telling the story because it couldn't be a kind of third-person narrator. It couldn't be you telling us what they thought. It had to be them.
No, I don't like being in my books. Not at all. But, I always start books in the third person. It's just a sort of knee-jerk response. I think, OK, I've got 4 points of view. I've got to have a third-person narration. That's it. That's what you do. And I started this book in the third person.
Oh, right, you did. You started,
I did, yeah. And I thought that's the only way you can do it with four people. I was writing this and I was feeling like there was just a sheet of glass between me and the story. I wasn't being able to really feel it. And, you know, it just felt so sort of hands off. And I remember at the time I was writing it, I think Matthew Neal had just written English Passages.
Passages.
Wonderful book. Absolutely, 20 narrators. And I thought, well, my measly old four isn't going to fox anybody, you know. So, it gave me a bit of confidence to sort of say, no, you can have four first-person narrators. And once I'd started writing it in the first person, it just came alive. It just sort of sprang out of the page. So I really love the first person.
And do you think there's special reasons now, especially looking back on it, there's special reasons to do with this particular story why it's important or useful to have these four monologues, in effect?
Yeah, because I want it... Because you don't... You know, you can see that all the characters don't know what the other characters know. The reader knows a lot more
yes.
than all the characters know throughout the book, and I thought that was very important. And that there was nobody there telling you what to think, nobody there sort of adding their... You know, another narrator, sort of... my voice, effectively, telling you what to think. And I just wanted you to see the world entirely... from that person's point of view. And I think with a story like this, where you are sort of trying to understand something like immigration, where you're trying to understand how people interact with each other, you just want to see the world from their point of view and accept them so that you can understand the difficulties or whatever.
Narratively, they are
yes.
segregated from each
yes.
other, aren't they?
Yes.
So, and in a novel which is so much about assumptions and prejudices... Mm. that just seemed like a kind of particularly sort of fitting way of doing it.
Yes, I mean, so a character like Bernard, who essentially is, you know, rather racist and difficult to understand. You know, I didn't want to be in a third person trying to look at this person because, you know, my own prejudices may have come into that. And I just wanted you to see the world from his point of view. And he does have a point of view, so that you understand where this comes from. It's the only way you can fight against it.
You keep him back for a long time, don't you?
I think
page 311, he says,
before
we hear from him. And then we hear a lot from him. And he's in the last 1948, he's in that last section as well.
Yes.
And I remember that slight shock at, you know, page 300 and something when he arrived. I mean, you must have thought about keeping him back, as it were.
Well, I knew the story, and the story had to keep him back. You know, he wasn't around for the first part of the story, and that was extremely important, that he wasn't around. I always knew he was going to come back. He's in the story. You hear about him from other people. But I'll admit that I actually loved writing Bernard. I mean, I loved writing his bit. The research for it and everything was fantastic. And in fact, I've got a lot more of Bernard at home in a box. And in fact, at one point I thought, I'm not going to call it small, just call it Bernard. You know, because there really was quite a lot of him, because it was fascinating to me.
Really, it's funny you should say that, because I think most people would think being inside Bernard's head, you know, is not a kind of particularly good place to be.
Because he was so different to me, because he was so... because I really did have to research him. I remember doing a lot of research with him with actual guys who had been in Burma and India in the RAF. And they were terribly generous with their time with me and taking me through everything that had happened to them. And I kept sitting there thinking, oh, and I'm going to write this awful character. I felt a little bit bad about that I wasn't going to, you know, express a really loving, wonderful character. But I do think Bernard is a nice character. I don't think he's a bad man.
Yeah. The things which, as a reader, you end up then understanding about Bernard and maybe being, therefore, slightly more forgiving of him, his wife never really gets to find out.
Well, quite, yes. And certainly Gilbert never gets to find out. You know, nobody gets to find out. And even if they did, they may not have been sympathetic to him. I didn't need you necessarily to be sympathetic to him, but just to know how he became like he became.
What about the... I mean, I was thinking also while you were doing your reading, you chose the bit of Queenie was from the prologue.
Mm.
And Queenie, given that she is, her voice is quite a powerful, obviously quite a powerful part of the book, actually it's quite a while, apart from the prologue, until she speaks, if that's the right word for it. You know, it's 110 pages
or so.
Gosh,
you know more than a page. 110?
Somebody once said, now you mustn't tease me, because somebody once said, there a long, long time ago, somebody who seemed quite wise, when I got my first academic job, said, page numbers. If you know the page numbers, they'll believe a lot else besides. why did you choose to give her that?
To give her a prologue.
Yeah, and that particular one of going to the British Empire, is that exhibition?
Well, she doesn't actually come into the book until page 111. So, you know, I wanted to start this book in Britain. You know, I wanted to really start this book with somebody who really thought they were British, you know, absolutely that sort of British Empire, and, you know, it's sort of... So I wanted just to her to be unequivocal. Yes, there she is. And she's talking about a time before the war, a time when perhaps white people in Britain thought it was always going to stay like that, and that this was how the world was, and this was how the world both will stay and should stay. And then this was going to be a world that is going to change from under her. So I wanted to show that world a bit.
You would otherwise think perhaps the novel was going to be about Hortense and Gilbert, I guess.
You know, the book is about both sets of people, and I wanted to sort of to show that strike, you know, early on.
And the voices. Queenie's voice comes from Nottinghamshire, does it?
Yes, my accent doesn't. It comes from Coronation Street.
I don't know. It wasn't.
No, really. No.
Nobody shouted shame in the audience, did they? You can hear that accent in your ear, a Nottinghamshire accent.
I can hear Coronation Street. That's what I'm hearing. That sort of, northern, that's... I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. My husband is from Sheffield.
Right.
And so his family are from that sort of part of the world, the Midlands and Sheffield. So I kind of have it in my head, but I can't speak it. But that's what I was hearing.
Why did she have to... I mean, it's all about London. It's all set in London, the 1948 sections. Why did she have to be from somewhere else?
I had done a lot of research. I mean, one of the things was that I'd done a lot of research and I'd asked my mother-in-law a lot, and a lot of the stuff on the farm. It's very hard to have someone from London who lived on a farm.
Yes.
And I wanted somebody who had a very similar upbringing to Hortense, thousands of miles apart, but actually had quite a lot in common.
On the book club website, there's a blogger who, right. And it said something like, "Hello, Andrea," and it was about exactly that. And so the blogger wrote, "Both Hortense and Queenie married men they disliked as a means to facilitate a move to the big city, create a better life for themselves."
I don't know whether I did it consciously. I remember becoming aware that they had quite similar lives, and if only they knew it, they would... they could have been very good friends.
Yeah. And what about this back and forth movement, which it sounds as if something that kind of emerged in the course of you doing it. I mean, why did that become important?
Well, it was just that I was writing. I started this, story in 1948, but it was always like, but what brought them to this place? And the thing is, I was thinking about my own parents' sort of immigration and realizing that 1948 was so close to the end of the Second World War, and you couldn't get away from the Second World War. And so, in order to do that, I had to sort of go back and just show you what sort of lives led to this happening. Mm. That was very important.
The date of it, obviously, it's the date of the Empire Windrush arriving. It's a date.
Yeah, my parents came to this country in 1948, and my dad was actually on the Empire Windrush, which was one of the reasons that, I wanted to explore this story,
as a novelist, are there other things about writing, setting a novel in the 1940s that are sort of interesting as for a novelist? I ask that partly because... It is a period that novelists, ambitious, good novelists, seem to have been peculiarly interested in, I think, in the last few years. And there's obvious Ian McEwan, Sarah Waters,
Well, it's an incredible time.
Yeah.
I mean, the Second World War and its aftermath, which we're still living through, but, it was an enormous schism in the middle of the sort of 20th century. I mean, it's absolutely ripe for... story. I think you could set every writer in this country writing a story set in the Second World War and you for the next 12 years, and you wouldn't get anywhere near the what actually happened to so many people. So it's very intense period of time. So I can see why novelists would go there, because there's so much to write about.
It's a period where the rules, I suppose, the prejudices about how people can act, how people can behave sexually, who people can count as their friends or lovers or wives or husbands, are quite stern, quite restrictive. That creates a certain intensity.
But actually, if you are dealing with the Second World War, all those sort of things that you just mentioned all sort of disappeared as well. They had to, because people were in a life and death struggle. I mean, that's what was happening. And when you're actually going through it, you don't have the hindsight of knowing it's all going to be all right. You don't know when your husband goes off to India and Burma whether you are ever going to see him again. So all sorts of things happened and did happen at that time. And we know they happened, from all the sort of fallout that happened afterwards. It's very interesting from that point of view, just from sort of human nature, and human nature when it's really put under strain.
Right.
What happens? How do you behave?
The initial one night with Queenie and Michael is a kind of...
Yes, yeah. I'm not sure that that would have happened. If he'd just sort of turned up. Yes. You know, I think that the intensity of he was an airman, yeah. he was going away, her husband was away, you know, this is something that may well have happened just because you're just not sure whether you're going to be, you know, what's going to happen to you the next day.
I mean, this brings us to the plot of the book. I want to talk a bit about that. Because not all novels have plots, actually.
No.
There's some quite good novels which don't have much of a plot, but your novel definitely
has a plot.
Yeah, well, no, I think lots of readers quite enjoy it too. And, I mean, the things we were talking about earlier about the sort of chronological structure of it and having the different narrators also serve the plot quite kind of cunningly as well, don't they? And particularly Queenie and Michael.
Some of these things are not accidental. I won't say it was accidental, but I didn't write it, as I say, in a chronology. So I was writing, you know, maybe Queenie's bit and then going back. And I remember very well the day that I realised that Michael was going to turn up on Queenie's doorstep. And I thought, yes, it's going to work, you know, because, you know, I hadn't sort of planned it that way. It just sort of, yeah, that was going to work. And then Michael sort of kept turning up. And I thought, yes, that's how it's going to work. The other person who sort of fell into the book was Arthur, yes. who is Bernard's father. And you get to know him sort of backwards.
Yes.
So you don't, you know very little about him, and you get his story sort of coming through. And that was, I won't say accident, because obviously I'm a writer, I'm in complete control of everything. But there was a certain, once I put it together, I realised, oh, that's working quite well. Yeah. And so you can sort of then, you know, work on that.
Yeah, because also you do this thing which, there should be a name for it. This is a brilliant thing, which actually, to mention her again, George Eliot does it in Adam Bede.
Please feel free
and
to mention George
And Walter Scott
Eliot.
Does it in Heart of Midlothian, which is to make a plot turn on the fact that the central female character has been pregnant.
Oh, right.
And none of the other characters have realised, nor has the reader.
Right.
And you make it also turn on a kind of on a coincidence. You know, I remember when I was first doing Dickens, somebody who was teaching me said, mediocre writers novelists avoid coincidences, but really good novelists adore them.
It's not such a big coincidence, actually. That's the thing about it. It feels like a big coincidence, Michael's sort of turning up on Queenie's doorstep. But that's the way the book struck me. But if you actually, you know, read it very carefully, you'll see that it wasn't a really big coincidence. The coincidence is that Hortense knows Michael.
But then that leaves you back to where we were about characters not knowing about each other. That leaves you, the ending, we come to that at the ending, we have this coincidence, but also, as it seems a really, the strongest, the most powerful example of the reader knowing something that the characters don't know. So we see this final connection. And you even do this kind of quite sort of, it's not mischievous exactly, but quite naughty thing where they, you know, she said, what's he called?
Yes, yeah.
And Queenie says, Michael, and she flinches, Hortense flinches. But she doesn't get it. She gets something different from what actually that is evidence of. Was that a eureka, your discovery, your decision to make it like that?
Well, that was a decision. Yeah. That was sort of, I really was writing the end of the book when I was writing the end of the book. That was the only bit of chronology. And I remember thinking, okay, are they going to find out about Michael?
Yes.
And I remember thinking, and you'll hate me for saying this, I remember thinking, oh, I'm so close to the end of the book, I'd have to write another couple of chapters. You know, so I... it can be as prosaic as that. You know, I just thought, no, they're not going to find out, because, you know, you would have to unravel that within the plot, and it just didn't need it. I think the book would have been a bit flabbier for that.
Yeah. Andrea's going to read do the
Bernard
men now.
And Gilbert. So I'm going to start with Bernard. Bernard's just arrived in India. I was thrown from the truck when we finally reached the base out east, my face landing in the dirt. A mouthful of parched dust had me spitting and choking. Someone stood on my leg. No time to yell before another tripped over me, stood on my hand as he staggered and fell, cursing. Everyone was running. The ground rumbled with pounding boots. Men shouted, "Move, move, cover!" I got to my feet, ran with my head low, the dirt kicking up into my eyes. I could barely see, just followed other moving legs. There was a screech of a low plane, one, two more perhaps. Had no time to look before gunfire was hitting the ground, dust erupting in a line, its debris pelting me in the chest. I screamed, I admit. My boots skidded along the ground to change direction. The dust was like fog. I was blind, lost, no idea which way to go. Then someone grabbed me, ripped my shirt as he pulled me towards a trench. It was full of men. There was no room. I know I shouted, "Budge up," before I was pushed over. "Get in," yelling in my ear. I landed on top of someone, my forehead cracking against the back of his head. "Watch what you're fucking doing," screamed into my face. Everyone was shouting, "Get your fucking head down, you stupid Irk." The plane passed low again, had us all wriggling, ducking, swearing. Bullets pelted into the dust, which flew high into the air, then fell, covering us like a suffocating blanket. I watched the planes, two Japanese Zeros swooping and strafing the ground. Their gunfire sometimes pinged and popped like harmless fireworks, but so close. I could see the pilot, thought I saw him laugh. Then someone landed on me, a mountain of a man, crashed into my back, winded me. I gulped, couldn't yell. There was an explosion, an almighty bang that left everything silent for one brief second, until stones and earth fell in on us like hail. Everyone was choking and coughing, their arms over their heads and mouths. The dust surrounded us like a London pea super. I couldn't breathe, as sure as if someone had clapped their hand over my face. I scratched at the air, trying to inhale, involuntarily grabbed a man at my side who shrugged me off, gulped mouthfuls of thick, unbreathable yellow filth. My mouth was dry, my tongue fat. The noise of the plane soon faded to a buzz like distant bees, and I breathed. I breathed a smelly lungful of the sweetest breath I'd ever tasted. Suddenly it was over. Japs were gone. The relief had the whole trench sighing as one man. "Get off my fucking arm, you broken it, you clumsy bastard." Someone was talking to me. I moved off him, said I was sorry, but he'd stopped listening. We began clambering out of the trench, all of us coughing and spitting like tubercular cases. I lost my balance and slid back down. It was then I noticed an unmistakable bulge in the front of my shorts. I had an erection. And now Gilbert. My mirror spoke to me. It said, "Man, women gonna fall at your feet." In my uniform of blue, from the left, from the right, from behind, I looked like a god. And this uniform did not even fit me so well. But what is a little bagging under waist and tightness under the arm when you're a gallant member of the British Royal Air Force? Put several thousand Jamaican men in uniform, coop them up while Grand Old Duke of York style, you march them up to the top of the hill and then back down again, and they will think of nothing but women. When they are up, they will imagine them, and when they are down, they will dream of them. But not this group I traveled with to America. Not Hubert, not Fulton, not Lenville, not James, not even me. Because every last one of us was too preoccupied with food. The only flesh we conjured was the sort you chewed and swallowed. This was war. There was hardship I was prepared for, bullet, bomb, and casual death. But not for the torture of missing cowfoot stew. Not for the persecution of living without curried shrimp or pepper pot soup. I was not ready. I was not trained to eat food that was prepared in a pan of boiling water, the sole purpose of which was to rid it of taste and texture. How the English built empires when their armies marched on nothing but mush should be one of the wonders of the world. I thought it would be combat that would make me regret having volunteered. Not boiled up potatoes, boiled up vegetables, grey and limp on the plate like they had been eaten once before. Why the English come to cook everything by this method? Lucky they kept that boiling business as a national secret and did not insist that the people of their colony stop frying and spicing up their food. I was brought up in a family with 10 children. At that dining table at home, one lax moment and half my dinner could be gone to my neighbour. I learned to eat quickly while defending my plate with a protective arm. But with this English food, I sat back, chewed slowly, and willed my compatriots to thieve. I had not yet seen a war zone. But if the enemy had been frying up some fish and dumpling, who knows which way I would point my gun.
Okay, I'm gazing out now into your serried ranks. There's a gentleman at the very back.
You described the way you structured the book. Did you strive, I was going to say manfully, but that's quite wrong. Did you strive to make as many episodes as funny as possible?
I believe that humor is part of the human condition. So when I sit down to write a book, I never think, oh, well, I'm writing a tragedy or I'm writing a comedy, or I just want to write and express people's natural sort of sense of humor. I don't have many jokes except when Gilbert tells them, but it's about humour that comes out of characters. And I know that in my everyday life, every day I can safely say I probably laugh at something that someone says or something that's happened, or, you know, it's just very much part of the human fabric. And to sort of leave it out would feel odd. And also, there is a wonderful sort of sense of humour that comes out of Jamaica that I wanted to sort of put into the mouth of Gilbert, that sort of rather dry but constant, funny way of looking at things, and also with the English characters as well. So I just feel humour is just all around us all the time.
Apart from your conversations with your mother, can you talk to us about the kind of research that you did to get such a rich picture of the immigrants that came to the UK, and also about the experience of mixed race relationships? What kind of research did you get to get that picture?
Some of it wasn't research. Some of it was just, you know, I've lived a life too. At that particular time, some of the sort of the stuff about the West Indian servicemen and how they were treated and things like that, that there were books that were written by West Indian servicemen, and I found out stuff from that. There's sort of stuff about, when you say about the immigration, do you mean in the 1948 bit, how they were treated? A lot of that came from my own parents. A lot of that story was when I finally got my mum to sort of talk to me about her experience of being in Britain. So the thing about, you know, sitting on a bed eating cornflakes quietly because there was somebody asleep and you're about to get in the bed was something that was an experience that my dad had. Certainly all the stuff for Hortense about becoming a teacher, the walking in the cupboard was my mum's story, bless her. You know, that actually happened to my mum and she still hasn't lived it down.
I was quite struck by something you said earlier about how in some ways Britain's recovering still from the legacy of World War II and a lot of the things that happened then. And one of the things I really enjoyed about your books is the way that you address issues about kind of the ambiguity and the complexity of that legacy, especially for me personally around issues of kind of mixed race and identity that I think. And I was just wondering, I think I read somewhere that you said you wrote some of your books because you felt these issues needed to be addressed, or that they were books you wanted to read yourself. And is that something that you feel as a society we do need to kind of address more and think about?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, when I was sort of growing up, I was terribly sort of ambivalent. Oh, I don't even think, ashamed, I think is the word, of my sort of Caribbean heritage. You know, we didn't talk about it, and I just wanted it to go away. I just didn't want to be from that part of the world. And as I've grown up, I found out about it, and I'm making up for that lost time. And I've become absolutely passionate about finding out about that heritage, because I think it's an incredibly important part of British history. What happened in the Caribbean islands and how we are now, and you know, the British Empire, you know, is incredibly important. And we're now in a sort of post-empire world. We're having to learn to adapt to what the legacy of that empire was.
I know we've talked about baby Michael, but on the comments that you've just made, he would be my age, and he would want to know who his father was. So I'm really quite curious as to how Hortense would have coped with that.
This is a lot of people have sort of read the book and sort of said, but what happens next? And I just go, ooh, because, you know, that's, you framed, yeah. I framed a book and there is no...
You know, people used to do that, Jane Austen's
friends
and family used to do it. And after it, she resisted at first, but after a while she used to just say, oh yeah, Jane Fairfax, she has another 3 years. And then...
Well, I always say, oh well, what happened was that Queenie and Bernard, they split up, that wasn't going to work, and that Queenie stayed in contact with Hortense, and she was very much part of Michael's life, you know, because I thought that would be... whether he ever finds out about the father, I don't know. That's a difficult one.
But he'd have to, because he would be my age, and
he'd want
and
to know.
And we know how easy it is now, and how curious people are now.
I saw the baby Michael as a symbol of something rather different, and I didn't personalise him as much as some of the other commentators have. It seems to me that he was your focal point for the discussion of something that we haven't discussed head on yet, which is prejudice. Wow, here we have this mixed race baby, and we have these poor people in the room, and suddenly, poof, denouement. How are they all going to react to the baby who epitomises all these different points where they're coming in. So
okay.
I thought it was incredibly clever, but I didn't actually see baby Michael so much as a person, so much as a kind of vehicle for you bringing people together and making them to confront how they were going to deal with their prejudice, which is a kind of abstract idea, when they see a real baby.
Isn't fiction wonderful?
Isn't it wonderful?
Really, so the most fantastic thing about fiction is that you sort of read a book and there can be many, many, many readings of it, and people get different things from it and they feel different things. I mean, often people want the writer to have known that. You would like me to say, yes, he is a symbol for this, that and the other, but that's not how fiction works. It works because it's there, it's out there, and what you get from it, how you interpret it, is because that's who you are and how you see the world. And it's a fantastic form because of that. And I really thank you for that, because that's a sort of, you know, well, what everybody said about the book is, you know, generally never what you sit and think about when you're writing. But that when it goes out there, it has a life of its own. And to hear people sort of saying that you've helped them confront prejudice or something like that, it's just wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And I say, yeah, for fiction.
I've been reading a lot about Caribbean African servicemen in the Second World War and the First World War. And to me, this is my interpretation, it almost seems like there's a history lesson that you've given people that isn't out there. And I just wondered whether you felt that was part of the role of the novel, was, you know, there's a bit of ignorance about the contribution of the Caribbean. Yeah.
The ignorance was mine as well when I started writing this book. I knew that my uncle was in the RAF, and then I realised there were 6,000 men who volunteered from the Caribbean, and I remember talking to somebody who was from the Caribbean, and there was a march just after the war, of all the service people, and the Caribbean servicemen weren't invited. And, you know, that, you know, so there is a part of me that wanted to to show that as well, and because it is very important, and it's part of that sort of relationship that I was talking about with the Caribbean and Britain, and how important that relationship is, and how important it is for us to understand it.
Relating to your choice of title, which I saw as an ironic comment on both prejudice on the one hand, and you might argue that this is small-mindedness, and that was found actually both in Jamaica and in Great Britain.
Oh, if you knew how we chose book titles, you know, nobody would ever ask you about them. But Small Island for me was just, it was something that came up a lot in the book, and it came up a lot in the Jamaican sections, because in Jamaica, people like to think that they live on a rather large island and that everybody else lives on a very small island. And that, and this sort of, that's their sort of prejudice that goes on, and small islanders are all a bit, you know. And then we have Britain, which has been an empire that that has come back to what it is, a small island as well. And that was my thinking. And it was because with this novel, I somehow I always know that titles are in there somewhere. They're in the book, they're in there, and you just got to find them.
So the book, as it were, existed before the title?
Oh, the title was one of the last things.
Andrea, I really wanted to be here today just to say thank you to you for writing the book. I'm a similar age as you, and my parents came here in the 50s, and reading the book was a really emotional journey. I laughed and I cried, and it really helped me to understand where my parents were coming from, physically and emotionally, psychologically. It was a great experience reading the book, and when I finished it, I thought, I've got to thank this woman for writing this book.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.